The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, August 25th, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today, Hillary Clinton filled a role that presidential candidates have not yet considered, but could actually prove quite useful. Like some sort of pants-suited version of Google, Mrs. Clinton gave a 30-minute address dedicated to defining what could be a confusing term that's being thrown around a lot lately on the internet. Now, to some, it was weird and inappropriate that a presidential candidate would spend so much time discussing dicks out for Harambe. No, that wasn't the term at all. The term was alt-right. Here's Hillary Clinton's definition.
Now, alt-right is short for alternative right. The Wall Street Journal describes it as a loose but organized movement, mostly online, that rejects mainstream conservatism.
Alt-right. Such a cutting-edge phrase, like an alt-weekly or alternative music. What could alt-right mean? Is it a right-wing creed unconcerned with the mores and niceties of the old ways? Yes. Yes, it is. But here's an easier way to understand what alt-right means. Racism. It's just racism. Specifically, Nazi-inflected racism. Alt-right. If you like alt-right, check out the alt-right's newest app, Discriminator. That has no E's near the end. It's a sharing economy version of a meetup. Find other like-minded alt-righties in your nabe. It's disrupting the clavern space of yore. Now, other members of the right say, well, that ain't me. And that is a tension that goes back a long way since modern conservatism was essentially invented. William F. Buckley fought with the John Birchers to purge them from his constituency as they defined conservatism at the National Review. He didn't want the white supremacist adherents. But think for a second about a couple of those other alts I mentioned, right? Alt weeklies and alt rock. At bottom, they're shedding away the inessential trappings. They're celebrating the essential nature of the noun that the alt is modifying. So like the Village Voice in its heyday could engage in a purer form of journalism than the corporate beholden mainstream papers. Same with the screaming guitars of the Pixies to choose an alt rock band, right? It was a rocking rebuttal to the tempered sounds of sync music and whatever else was going on in the early 80s. So what does this say about the right, the regular right? Well, maybe nothing. Maybe alt-right's just a cynical label. And if you listen to Hillary's speech, she was careful not to argue that the Republican Party has countenanced racism. The Republican Party allowed the alt-right phenomenon to grow. And this is because of the strategy of the speech. It was an appeal to the middle. It was an appeal to the kind of white voter who doesn't see himself as racist. Here, listen to this part.
The names may have changed. Racists now call themselves racialists. White supremacists now call themselves white nationalists. The paranoid fringe now calls itself alt-right. But the hate burns just as bright.
This tone is a rebuttal to what Trump is doing, how he's asking African-Americans to vote for him. You know, the what else do you have to lose argument. His appeal is not really to African-Americans. It's to white people who are uncomfortable voting for a candidate that they think is actually racist. But even though this might not serve Hillary's purposes today, let us not let all Republicans, all mainstream Republicans, totally off the hook for the rise of the alt-right in their midst. It behooves Republicans to acknowledge the alt-right, to grapple with the phenomenon, to seriously question why the alt-right exists within Republicanism, and to do something, in fact, to do everything possible to make sure that voters know that the alt-right is not all right. On the show today, I spiel about Donald Trump pollster, but first, let's get lost in a conversation about GPS.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I'm going to name three things and you tell me what's the common thread, or even more to the point than the common thread, what did they inspire? Vietnamese bombing runs, William F. Buckley, and Chuck E. Cheese. What do those things, try to locate in your mind what those things might have in common. The answer is GPS. In a way, in a roundabout way. The book is called Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. Greg Milner wrote it. He's here. Hello, Greg.
Hello.
All right, let's go through them all. Vietnamese bombing runs. What do they have to do with GPS? They're pretty important. Of the three, those are
of
the most
important.
Of the three,
important. It's probably the most, yeah. Well, GPS origins extend back, you know, almost to Sputnik. But the people who really got it going after the Naval Research Laboratory did a lot of preliminary work, and some very important work, were a few Air Force officers, particularly one named Brad Parkinson. And these were people, by and large, not all of them, but many of them, who had been involved in Vietnam in the air campaigns. And Brad was particularly disillusioned with what he saw as the indiscriminate bombing in Vietnam. I mean, he was sickened by it. The way he put it is that they hadn't learned anything from World War II and were still doing carpet bombing.
Right, so, when they had the flying fortresses.
Right, right. And just kind of like, you know, bombing.
Planes that would, and flying fortresses are planes that would, they were so heavily armored because the enemy could see you if it was during the day, you'd have to have these gigantic planes.
Right. And the idea was, as Brad put it, it was to incite terror as much as any sort of like tactical or strategic reason. So his idea of why he had a background in navigation, among other things, was that he wanted something that would basically make a more humane form of warfare, as he saw it. I mean, his motto was come up with a way to drop five bombs in the same hole. And that's what he wanted. So as he saw it, that there would be this way for the Air Force to do that, to make sure that when they bombed something, they bombed exactly what they wanted to bomb.
Yeah. And by the way, there was skepticism. You would think, or one might think, that the Air Force, whoever, the military would say, wow, thanks, that'll help. But no.
Yeah, it's actually one of the craziest parts of the GPS story is that the Air Force tried to kill its own program starting in the early 70s and really several times right up until Operation Desert Storm in 1990 when GPS just kind of broke wide open in terms of warfare. Their attitude was like, we have navigation systems. Why do we need another one? What the people involved in GPS like to say is, okay, this isn't a navigation system. It's a positioning system, which is a subtle but kind of, you know, very important distinction that this is somewhere to know exactly where you are or where something is at any moment. And the Air Force just didn't see it.
By the way, the history of munitions, and especially the history of air battle, is that this is now the weapon that will end wars. I mean, that's what the Wright brothers said about the plane. There'll be no point to ever having a war since we have this destructive machine that could just obliterate. Did they actually wind up being correct that it was that pinpoint surgical strikes are a more humane way of warfare? Or like everything else, from the airplane to the hot air balloon to the Gatling gun, people just said, wow, we could kill much more efficiently. Let us kill.
Yeah, I think that's more to the point. Plus, there's all kinds of unforeseen or unintended consequences with this kind of precision. I mean, there's a straight line from that way of thinking right up to drones, which use GPS. I mean, just because you're precise doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be, you know, well, assuming that any bombing is humane, let's just, is that there's no reason that just because you're precise, it's going to make for a better type of warfare necessarily.
All right, so I mentioned Chuck E. Cheese and William F. Buckley. Chuck E. Cheese was kind of a tease. Tell me, what's the Chuck E. Cheese connection?
Well, the guy who was Nolan Bushnell, who started Chuck E. Cheese, among other things, really brilliant guy, is one of the founders of Atari. His idea with Chuck E. Cheese was that he wanted to vertically integrate. He saw that the arcades were making more money than he was building the machines. So he's like, well, why don't we build the machines and then have this thing? And he's like, and we don't, it was just pizza. Pizza's easy to make. Kids don't care what it tastes like. So he did that and it was a big success, but he was also an avid sailor and he was very into navigation. So he had this idea to start a navigation system that was kind of a proto GPS technology, I mean, called ETAC.
And but the point there is that if the military guys were the ones who really invented and popularized it, Bushnell took it as a consumer product.
Yeah.
And that's where William F. Buckley comes in. And Sailing, his high-profile endorsement, put it on the map. Oh, my God. Sorry to make that pun.
It was inevitable. It was coming. Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, Buckley was, you know, another, a very serious sailor. And he heard about one of the very earliest and probably the most pioneering GPS company called Trimble, which still exists to this day in a certain form. But Charlie Trimble was a really forward-thinking guy in terms of what GPS could achieve, not just in navigation, but he foresaw how it could be used by surveyors and other people. His idea was that it's an incredibly precise signal. What can we use it for? So Buckley heard about it and interviewed one of the—he was particularly impressed because one of the guy, early Trimble hires, Javad Ashjai, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, had recently emigrated from Iran to escape the revolution. And he was very inspired by that story. And so Buckley was a believer, and he wrote a big story in the New York Times Magazine saying how amazing this was, because he knew as a sailor, you know, when you're way out on the open ocean before GPS, your options were much more limited.
So as I said, so the story, how it works, hey, we use this every day, that's interesting. But to me, the book really thrives on the implications. And one of your theories, not just your theory, you flesh it out through relying on research, is that it's affecting and perhaps damaging our sense of our place in the world. So it's about, we understand, or it allows, it gives us a shortcut to navigate space, but it doesn't allow us to really think about place. And that's a distinction.
Yeah. I mean, the term that psychologists and other cognitive scientists use is the cognitive map, a term that goes back to the 40s. A psychologist named Edward Tolman came up with it. And it's essentially the idea that we have an ingrained sense of spatial relations and moving through the world and where things are in relation to other things. He did experiments with rats that showed that they could have a very sophisticated cognitive map of the maze they were running through. Basically, if you use GPS, and studies have shown this, you don't need to use your cognitive map much, right? I mean, anyone who's being honest, if they've used GPS to go through a strange area, knows how you can just let that soothing voice do the work for you. So there's mounting evidence that it's actually affecting our cognitive map. I mean, you know, degrading it actually in a way.
So will that have implications to other ways of thinking? It's sort of like the kids who learn two languages have parts of their brain that are sparked. So are we becoming just unilingual? Are we, you know, is it possible that whatever else the mapping parts of our brain can help us in terms of cognition, that might wither and die?
Yeah, I mean, your brain is somewhat flexible, right? I mean, there was that famous study a few years ago of London cab drivers that who need to know an incredible amount of geographic information and where things are in relation to everything else. And the gray matter in that part of the brain that's responsible for that actually increased. Now, an interesting thing about the corollary of that, they also found it was less publicized because the results were a little bit less conclusive, but they also looked at retired cab drivers and saw that gray matter then, you know, shrunk a little bit once they no longer had to use all that. So, you know, one of the neuroscientists I talked to was involved in that study said, it's early to say, but it seems very possible that GPS could be having that same effect on people. I mean, if you're not using a part of your brain that's for spatial relations, there might be changes in it.
So the subtitle, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds, we talked a little bit about how it was perhaps changing gray matter. What about culture?
It affects the way we all live in a way because we're all dependent on it, whether we know it or not. Here's a good example. You know, one of the fastest growing segments of the GPS industry is fleet management, which is a euphemism for people being tracked, right? I mean, it's incredible how big an industry that is. Fleet management packages are purchased by employers or government agencies whose employees drive company cars. And it's amazing how much money you can save with this. But if you ask the people, I've looked at these studies, you know, the bosses, what they most like about it, it's not so much the money they save, and they save significant amounts of money. These packages pay for themselves. What they like most about it is knowing where their employees are. Yeah. And I think that's sort of we live in a surveillance culture, right? I mean, we're in a surveillance state in one way or another. And I think in a way that this is a way it's kind of trickled down into everyday life. We just sort of take it for granted that we live in a world where we know where everyone and everything is.
There's also parts about the phenomenon death by GPS, which is a phrase that I think park rangers use.
Yeah, Death Valley.
Yeah, to describe people who get lost. But occasionally people do die. Now, there's a certain macabre glee that perhaps the media takes in this. Also, people who fall off mountains via selfie sticks. And is this the part of human nature where like half the Twilight episodes were based on the premise, you know, beware technology or be careful what you wish for? Just a part of human nature that is so suspicious of technology. And then when people rely on it, we take our pleasure in knowing that, you know, they were praising a false god.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a sort of – yeah, because I've noticed that too. It's what everyone, you know, really wants to talk about regarding GPS. It's death, but yeah. It's – and I think there's a certain whistling past the graveyard quality to it, because honestly, whether people admit it or not, I think if people are being honest, they'll realize that the way they've used GPS, all of us at one time or another, you know, we could imagine something like that happening. I mean, there's really two kinds of death by GPS things. One, the ones first are just kind of funny where you can laugh at the people, right? Like this guy would turn right into the ocean, which yes. Has really happened, if you know, or, you know, drove off nearly off a cliff because GPS said that was a road, not a hiking trail. And those are like, ha ha ha. And then there's the ones like where people follow their GPS in Death Valley, for example, where it tells them to turn right onto a road that is a road, but it's a disused road. It's maybe an old mining road. It's something only for off-road vehicles. And that's harder to laugh at, not just because the results are often tragic, you know, death or serious injury, but just because, well, that's a road. They yeah. followed their, you know, they followed the directions.
The last 100 times you used GPS, you turned on a road you hadn't been to before. And if that road degraded and was off the grid, you'd be in trouble too.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about death by GPS, you know, it's in some ways a misnomer, right? Because GPS itself works very, very well. Death by GPS is really more caused by something else. It's death by the person using GPS or by the map program or something. It's not really death by GPS per se.
Okay, so let's go with the practical. Are you a Google Maps or an iPhone GPS guy?
Oh, Google Maps, I guess.
Why?
Because that's just what I've always used. Uh-huh. I mean, it's just sort of, it's, you know, I started and that's just kind of what I've continued to use.
When I'm a Google Maps guy because the iPhone one just is not good at anticipating what I'm typing in. I might write the street I live on and it'll say, oh, that name of that street in Halifax? No, not in Halifax, you idiot. What about when an app asks you, can I track your location? What do you say about that?
You know, I always do because I have a sort of perverse interest in why they're doing it, and I'd like to figure out why is it doing this. But yeah, that doesn't bother me because I understand why they're asking me that, and it's for some sort of, you know, they want to serve me up some sort of ad, probably. They want to know where I am. It's for their research purposes, and so I just take it for granted that they're going to do that anyway.
So is there, as an expert in GPS as you are there any tips or any ways that you use it that people don't, that they should, or ways that people are using GPS wrong?
Well, look at the directions before you start following them, for example. I mean, because there's, you know, like you said, that gives you the wrong street. You know, there's a guy just recently became an international semi-celebrity, well, at least in Iceland, because...
But there's only 400,000 people, so he is one of the most prominent people in
that's
Iceland.
That's true. You know, he entered his, typed in the wrong street name when he wanted to go from the airport to the hotel in Reykjavik. And wanted.
And this is like a 23-character street name.
Right. Yeah. And the funny thing is, it wasn't his fault. And this is what I mean about how it's, you know, you can somehow unavoidable. He typed the street in right. It was wrong on his confirmation thing, and he wound up 250 miles away up near the Arctic Circle, and why he followed the directions that far is a mystery.
But he was committed. Pinpoint is the name of the book, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. Greg Milner, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Rachel Yucatel, and I'm here to invite you to listen to my podcast, Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. This podcast delves into the lives of those who have been reduced to a single headline. Each episode will take a closer look at the stories of those who are on a mission to change their narrative. Join me as we uncover the truth behind the misconceptions, shed light on the stories of those who have perhaps been wrongfully portrayed, explore the complexities of the human experience, and celebrate the power of second chances. Who doesn't love a good comeback story?
And now the spiel. Donald Trump is the worst major party candidate for president in my lifetime. He has revealed himself to also be the worst pollster.
Can we go through a process, or do you think they have to get out? Tell me. I mean, I don't know. You tell me.
That was Trump in a town hall type meeting on the Sean Hannity program, essentially outsourcing his immigration stance to the rule of the mob. Only the composition of his question was so inherently confusing that even the normally erudite, albeit hastily assembled on risers in a Fox studio, Hannity audience had a little trouble keeping up.
So do we tell these people to get out, number one, or do we work with them and let them stay in some form?
Okay, by a show of hands, a raise of hands, who are in, out, who says yes, no? By the way, that is how the LA Times USC tracking average is conducted. Trump, with the help of Hannity, tried again putting his question in a succinct and digestible way to the audience, who would thereafter determine the Republican candidate's policies.
Let's do a poll. How many think they should go through a process that maybe give them a chance? Clap. We got to hear you.
How many people?
How many think they should go?
But do it again. Do it again.
Putting aside the idea that the very correct idea that this is a total contradiction of Trump's stance is not a pivot, a contradiction, and the gobbledygook of policy and sentence construction that we just heard, I think people are wondering if all Trump is doing with this campaign is essentially setting himself up for a TV network by hiring Ailes and hiring Steve Bannon. But I don't think that's what's going on. I think Trump is starting a polling firm.
Look, this is like a poll. There's thousands of people in this room.
Okay. By a show of cheers, how many of you prefer the creamy peanut butter, but how many like the full-bodied flavor of Skull Bandits? Okay, one is creamy and one is smooth peanut butter. Peanut butter, you know, been working for years with jelly, stick to your mouth, your tongue, your wherever. Who says number one, the peanut butter? Okay, good. And who says, no, not good, the peanut butter, want the clean, crisp taste of Skull Bandits? Okay, how many? Good.
Well, this is like a poll.
Right.
But this is like a poll.
Okay, now how many want me to attack North Korea, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-sun, Un, Sung, whatever, and how many, show of hands, show of yeses, show of yells, who wants South Korea? Okay, South Korea to attack.
Wait, Mike, meaning we would attack them?
Or they would attack North Korea for us?
Yes, that. Right. Who thinks that and who thinks the other one?
Well, look, this is like a poll.
All right, last question. Who thinks this is a bad reality show or a good Fox News segment? All right, show of yells. All right, thank you all for your input today. Thanks to you, we're leading in Florida. And Anheuser-Busch, great people, tremendous people, are now coming out with a chunky beer. I do not think it'll sell. I do think it'll be a disaster. But I do think possibly the Mexicans are going to pay for it.
Well, look, this is like a poll.
Right.
That's it for today's show. Just producers Mary Wilson and Chris Berube are Alt-Control-Alt-Delete, meaning they like to restart their computers from the start screen, but it takes all 20 of their fingers to do so. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcasts, once got lost and had to be rescued from the inside of a Donald Trump sentence. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, is considering giving a podcast to a group who believes in purity and tradition in beer. They're the malt right. The Gist, polling. It's what killed Combs. Oompuru de Peru do Peru, and thanks for listening.